Thank
and you. Those of you who go to Khao Lak, you don't have to be afraid of ghosts, because right now you're looking at one, a Kwai Lo.
Is that me or you?
You're not Kwai Lo.
Getting there. We're all ghosts to be, right? Except you. But.
No.
Okay, Ajahn Brahm, I'm gonna start off by asking you, please define wisdom. And what is the difference between wisdom and intelligence?
I don't know. No, the difference between wisdom and intelligence. This is the first example. What is this? Does anyone know what this is? Orange juice, what else is it? What else? What else can you see? Describe this. Keep on describing it. What else is it? This is an exercise which I do to show the difference between intelligence and wisdom. The intelligence knows all the names of what this is. Orange juice, plastic, straw. But after a while, when you stop, or you either run out of all the names you have for this, then you may be able to see it, what it truly is. Beyond the words, that's where you find the wisdom. Who is the person you live with, the partner in your life? Do you know who they really are? If you think you know who they are, that's intelligence. But if you stop for a while and see something which you've never seen in your partner before, that's wisdom. Wisdom is knowing that you will never fully comprehend the person you live with. They will always show you new facets. You can never even understand yourself fully. You too will find different parts of yourself, strange and wonderful parts of yourself. That is wisdom. Intelligence is dead knowledge. Wisdom is alive, always seeing new things, always experiencing more interesting parts of you, the universe, and everything. Wisdom is open, intelligence is closed. Which is one of the reasons, one of my sayings, is never allow intelligence to stand in the way of truth. Some people are so intelligent, they can't see the truth, they're not wise. And there's the old story, one of my favorite stories, of the professor who went to the five-star restaurant. On the Straits Times coming in from Kuala Lumpur, I saw that the top 20 restaurants in the world, and there's one restaurant here in Singapore, is one of the top 20 restaurants in the world. And I remember a professor here in Singapore, he booked into that restaurant one day. He booked into the restaurant, he had to make a reservation, it took 2 months before he could get a seat. It was such a popular restaurant. And when he went to the restaurant, he had to wear a very, very good suit. That's why I can't go to very good restaurants, I haven't got a suit.
You only have a dress.
That's right, you know that story. That's actually another story.
Wait, finish one at a time.
Anyway, that was when I went to dinner with the Queen of Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth, I had a steak dinner with her.
You're supposed to wear a tuxedo.
Yeah, that was the, they have these beautiful cards, the invitation cards, all embossed and very beautiful, and it had the dress code. That was a big problem. There were three options. First was, again, the tuxedo, the black tie, they call it. And I asked, is that all you have to wear, a black tie, nothing else? I'm a monk, I don't know these things.
Cheeky, said, no, you've got to wear
a shirt and trousers. We don't have trousers in monastery, no shirts and no black ties, so I had to cross that one off. And the next option, number two, military uniform. I'm a monk, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a pacifist, don't have military uniform. So there was only one choice left, and that was, yes, long dress. I qualify! So that's how I could go to have dinner with the Queen of England. But anyway, that's a long time ago. And the professor, he went to this restaurant. They checked his ID. Yes, you have a reservation tonight. So he went into the restaurant. He sat at this table, this beautiful red mahogany table with silverware, beautiful chandeliers, and a butler in tails and just perfectly set up, because you would expect in a very expensive restaurant, gave him this menu made of thick parchment, written in calligraphy. It belonged in the Singapore Museum of Art rather than the restaurant. It was so beautiful. And he said, thank you so much. He received the menu. And then he ate the menu, paid, and left. Because the professor did not know the difference between the menu and the food. That's the difference between intelligence and wisdom. Intelligence may satisfy you intellectually, but the wisdom, it feeds the heart and makes you peaceful and lets go of all of the problems in life. So here, we don't give you menus. We give you food for the heart. And because Singapore people, they love eating, therefore this is very popular, food for the heart. And because I'm so wise, I've had so much food for the heart, which is why I'm so fat.
Vajrambhan, how do you develop wisdom?
How you develop wisdom? First of all, stop thinking for a bit. Because all your thinking is old ideas. It's all coffins of old views which stop you being wise. So first of all, be still. Let go of all that thinking. And then you can see. You can see what this is once you stop thinking about it. So this is how we become wise. Just what they used to say is to, you know, think outside the box. It's very easy for me to think outside the box because I live outside the box. I'm weird. So how you develop that wisdom is, instead of thinking, you learn how to see. And let wisdom come. A good example of that, many good examples of that, is when you're making a decision in life. How do you make those decisions in life? Thinking about it just makes you confused. This is a wise way of making decisions, not to think about it, but to feel it. And this happened in Oslo. I think I told a story last time, but who cares? I'm telling it again. Look, the reason why I retell these stories many times is because when you ask questions, you ask the same old questions again and again. It's only fair. You ask the same questions. I give the same stories.
Okay, go on then.
Okay. When I was in Oslo giving a talk in October, one of the questions is in Oslo University. This student put their hand up and said, I have to make a very important decision in life. How do I make those decisions? And I looked at her and I said, well, let's make it a bit more concrete. Let's give an example. Suppose the decision you were thinking about was, should I marry my boyfriend? And as soon as I said that, her jaw dropped. Her hands went to her face, which went bright red. And she turned around to the boyfriend sitting next to her. I'd sussed her out. That's what she was thinking about, and she was so embarrassed. I told her boyfriend what she was thinking.
That's because you use your psychic power.
But be careful, don't ask me a question like that, otherwise you'll be found out too. But anyway, I said, it's very easy. If you are making such an important decision in life, something which which will define your happiness or sadness for so many more years. You've got to make the decision with wisdom, not with thinking. So the way to do it is to toss a coin. But it's not tossing a coin the way you think. You toss the coin. Heads, I marry him. Tails, I don't. And it comes up heads. Heads, I marry him. And you think, 2 out of 3. That means you don't want to marry him. So tossing a coin is not to make the decision for you, but to find out what you really want to do. It comes up tails. No, I won't marry him. Yeah. And that shows you what you're really feeling inside. So this tossing a coin method is not to make the decision for you, but to discover what you really want to do. That is wisdom. I know it's so difficult sometimes making these decisions. We think. We just get more headaches, we get more stupid, and usually we just get paralyzed or we make a decision, it's the wrong one. But this one, where you come to your heart and you feel it in here, that's what the coin tossing does. You begin to feel it in here. That is wisdom.
So later on, we're going to put a stack of coins here. If you're going to come and ask Ajahn Brahm, should I do this or not? We'll ask you to toss the coin.
Very good.
So Ajahn Brahm, why is it where the most intelligent people are the ones who can't handle depression? They're the ones who are likely to be more suicidal.
That's an excellent question, because that's a really good point. The people who think that much are the ones who see so little. And that's the trouble with our education system. You become great thinkers and analysts. And a lot of time in modern education, you just repeat what other people said, and that's where you get the marks from. You don't do new things. You don't innovate. You don't see for yourself. That's, you know, to be serious, that's one of the reasons why I left Cambridge, left the academic life. I could have gone on to do research, but I left that because in a place like Cambridge University, you could hang out with people who won Nobel Prizes. These were brilliant people, but it surprised me. They were so intelligent, say, in theoretical physics, but they were stupid in life. A good example, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, one of the most famous physicists I've ever met was Sir Roger Penrose. He is the man who discovered black holes. He is Mr. Black Hole. And when I, being in Perth, I know all the physicists there, I got invited again to a dinner. I don't eat at these dinners. I sit around and talk to people all the time. But anyway, but it's really torture. The only dinner I never accepted was to Amnesty International. They're having, I think, a 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They invited me to the dinner to celebrate it. And I said, on principle, I cannot accept. Because you're Amnesty International who fight against torture. And you're inviting me to sit in a dinner and watch you guys eat when I can't eat anything. That is torture. And someone like Amnesty International should never be inviting me. But I wrote that to them. They thought it was very funny. But anyhow, all these dinners I've gone to, I went to the dinner with Sir Roger Penrose. Now, he is really famous. If there's any physicists here, or anyone in science, I mean, that is one of the leaders. He's up there with Stephen Hawking. Brilliant guy. But when I started talking to him, now he couldn't hold a conversation with you. Other people tried to talk to this famous man, and after a while they all gave up. And after about half an hour, he was standing like a wallflower. Everyone else was enjoying themselves. I was talking to some lady from NASA about some amazing stuff going on over there, really interesting stuff. But he was socially inept. Now that's one of the reasons that you can see the difference between intelligence and wisdom. Brilliant in a small field, stupid in life. And I thought that if you really are going to have a happy time and have a life which has meaning, be wise in life. In your sort of part of life, whether it's in business or whether it's in physics or whether it's in engineering, you don't be intelligent enough to make a living. But what's really important is to be wise in life.
Rajan Brahm, if you're very intelligent and you score straight A's all the time, and then you go into the workforce, and perhaps your career takes a negative turn, a lot of them can't handle it because they've never tasted failure.
Oh, yeah. That's, again, a sign of lack of wisdom. So what actually is wisdom? Is seeing things in an innovative way. So a long time ago, at some conference I went to, someone said, there's no such thing as failure. This is what we call forward failing. And just putting that one word forward in front of the word failure gave it a positive spin. What it meant is that yes, you fail, but you learn and you grow and you develop, which means that the act of losing your job or losing the contract or failing the exam means that you learn. It's the opportunity. And it's because of that that I gave a series of talks in Indonesia, and the main focus of that talk was a simile of 70%. When I was a school teacher, I had to set an examination in mathematics. I'd never set a school exam before, so I had to ask advice from, you know, the senior teachers. How do you set exams? And they said, if you set the exam at a difficulty level which is too high, and your students get an average mark of 30 or 40%, then they will think they can't do maths. They will lose their motivation. They will think they're useless. That will be a bad exam. And if you set an examination which is too easy, they'll get 95 or 100%. It's not testing them. You don't learn anything from that. But if you set the examination so the average score is about 70%, the children will be motivated. Yes, they can do this. But me as their teacher, I'll be able to identify their weak points. The places where they made mistakes were the parts of maths which I will focus on in the next few lessons. So they would grow. And I realized from that simile, that is what life is all about. If you always make 100%, you get straight A's, you're beautiful, you're powerful, you're rich, and you always can get the right boyfriend or girlfriend, and you get a nice career, and everything goes well for you. What a waste of a life that is. You learn nothing. And also, if you know you can't get any girlfriend, no boyfriend, you can't even get one A, you know, not even in sport or whatever else you do at school, and you really have a difficult time, then you really get depressed, and I can understand why. Usually for such people like that, you can't do anything in life. That's when I say, come and become a monk, I'll look after you. But
you
not all monks started
A
out like that. Yeah, I was straight A's. But this is what happens if you are about 70% in life. Yeah, you have success, but you have some failures. Those 30% where you fail, that is where you learn. That is the important, juicy part of life. That's where you get wisdom from. How many times have I said this to you? Almost every time I come to Malaysia, the treading in the, and again, you're gonna, I know Addie says I shouldn't say this word, but I think she's given up on me now. Treading in the dog shit. You go home from here, she's gonna tell me off again. But I've already said it, so it's too late. Treading in the dog shit on the way home, never scrape it off your shoes. Intelligence is scraping off your shoes. Wisdom is keeping it on your shoes until you get home. And then you scrape it off under your mango tree. I had mangoes this morning. They're very juicy. There must have been someone who followed my simile. Because if you scrape it off under your mango tree in the back of your house or in the common area or in the nearest park, 1 year later, those mangoes are going to be sweeter and juicier than ever before because of the dog shit, this fertilizer. The problem with people is that when they eat those mangoes, they forget what they're really eating. It's dog shit, but it's transformed. That's why the failures in life, when you lose your job, when your girlfriend dumps you, when your husband has a mistress, which happens really often, or someone commits suicide, that is the dog shit of life. It's smelly. It's really, you just don't want to keep it on your hands. It's awful stuff. But if you know how to use the failures of life, you create these incredibly juicy and sweet mangoes. You become a much wiser, kinder, full human being. It's the failures, the 30% where we fail. If we realize that that is forward failing, that is part of life, that's a juicy part of life. We put failure in a different situation.
The benefit only comes if one can take part of the responsibility or to recognize how one has contributed to the failure or the situation. But most times, people just want to blame other people for things going wrong.
Yeah, but sometimes with suicide, we just blame ourselves. That is a really weird stuff. Because it's not your fault. It's not her fault. It's not your parents' fault. It's not the government's fault. Whose fault is it? Our fault. It's a wonderful thing about life and relationships. If you commit suicide this evening, it's probably my fault for not giving a good talk this evening or telling those old jokes again and again and again. Just like the joke of the bear. I told a bear joke, did I? The bear and the magic duck and the rabbit last time. Because I told this afternoon. And people, when I had the prison, I went to Changi jail this afternoon. So, you know, it's really rough in the jail there. So I decided to cheer them up, tell them the joke about the bear, the rabbit, and the magic duck. Because once, and this is a good example of the difference between intelligence and wisdom. Once there was a bear and a rabbit who lived in a forest. And they were always chasing each other, usually the bear chasing the rabbit. They were just enemies. And one day they were chasing each other through the forest, making a loud noise. And they went right past the lake where the magic duck lived. And the magic duck was really fed up. You destroy the tranquility and the peace of this forest. Listen, you two. If you promise not to chase each other and live in peace and harmony, I will give you 3 wishes each. And the bear looked at the rabbit, and the rabbit looked at the bear. They shook their heads. Okay. So the bear had his first wish. Mr. Bear, what do you wish? And Mr. Bear said, I'm a man. It's really hard to, you know, a girl bear these days. So, I wish all the bears in the whole forest are all female, and I'm the only male. You know what men are like? Well, you soon will, because the magic duck went quack, and at one quack, all the bears in the whole forest were female, and he was the only male. Wow. Then they asked the rabbit for his first wish, and the rabbit said, I want a motorcycle crash helmet. And the duck said, what? And the rabbit said, look, you said I could have a wish. Stop questioning me. Just give it. Okay. Quack. And a big crash helmet appeared on the head of the rabbit. And the Mr. Bear had his second wish. And Mr. Bear said, I've just been thinking. All the other bears in the country will soon hear that in this forest there are only females. And they'll all come here and spoil my fun. So my second wish is all the bears in all the country are female, and I'm the only male bear in the whole nation. Quack! All the bears turned to females except him. He was very happy bear. And then they asked the rabbit for his second wish. And the rabbit said, for my second wish, I would like a Harley Davidson 1000cc motorbike to go with my crash helmet. Quack! And this beautiful, gleaming, sleek Harley appeared. Do you like motorbikes? I used to like motorbikes as a kid. Wow! And the rabbit jumped on top of the motorbike with his crash helmet, started to rev it up, vroom, vroom, vroom! And then they asked Mr. Bear for his third and last wish. And Mr. Bear said, look, I should have said this to begin with. When all the bears overseas hear there are only female bears here, they too will migrate. May all the bears on all of planet Earth be female and me the only male. Quack! And it was like a miracle. All the bears in the whole world were all female except him. He was the only male bear. And then it was the rabbit's last wish. And the rabbit on his motorbike, ready to make a quick getaway, said, my last wish is that Mr. Bear is gay.
So what's the moral of the story?
Now that's wisdom. That stupid bear.
That's true. If all you think about is the female.
Yeah.
So, John Bram, you had straight A's and graduated from Cambridge University, which is one of the top universities in the world.
Yep.
And then you went to Thailand to learn about wisdom from a monk who had little or no education.
Grade four education. And that this is true, that it was a shock and a surprise that I had this great education and this man had only grade four and he was so much wiser than I was. I couldn't believe it. In life, he knew what was going on and knew how to be peaceful and make incredible decisions. Well, this is one thing, one story which was super normal, but in his wisdom. It was a story when one day there was these headmen from the village came to the monastery, and they said there was a woman in that village who'd been possessed by a demon. And they'd been struggling with it all night, and they were going to bring this girl to Ajahn Chah so Ajahn Chah could exorcise this demon. I don't know if you've ever seen real possessions, but they are frightening. And now when we heard this, Ajahn Chah, this great master, he ordered two novice monks, one to dig a hole, the other one to boil water. Now that was one of the amazing things about this monk. I mean, he really did act out of the box. I had no idea at all what he was up to. And then we started hearing the screams of this woman as she was being dragged into this monastery. And she was swearing profanities, the most vulgar of words, in one of the most holy monasteries. In northeast Thailand, you just don't do that. But this lady really was crazy. And when they dragged her in to where Ajahn Chah was sitting, you know, she was foaming at the mouth. Her eyes were crazy. And there's about three or four really strong farmers, incredibly strong, were hardly able to restrain her. When someone is that mad, they've got incredible power. And all Ajahn Chah said, dig the hole deeper. We need more hot water. Quick! And we didn't know what Ajahn Chah was doing, but these poor novices were digging like they were going to die. And this woman was lunging at him, trying to get at him, spitting at him. She really was mad. And then Ajahn Chah said, we need more hot water, boiling water. We need to dig a bigger hole. This is a really fierce and dangerous demon in this woman. The only way to get this demon out is to bury her in this hole, pour boiling water all over her, and then bury her. That's the only thing we can do. Now, Ajahn Chah, he was so idiosyncratic, so exceptional, that even I thought he might do that. More importantly, that girl thought he might do that. She started calming down. And before the hole was dug and the water was boiled, she was sitting as calm as anything, exhausted, while Ajahn Chah just gave her the precepts and a blessing, and they calmly walked her back to the village to have a rest. That was just so brilliant. The emotional intelligence, which is really what we might call wisdom, he saw that there's something called self-preservation. If you're really crazy and mad, and you really, part of your brain or part of you thinks, oh my God, if I don't get my act together pretty quickly, this guy's going to pour boiling water over me and bury me alive, you get your act together pretty quick. Brilliant intelligence. And when I saw things like that, that's not what you learn in university. In fact, such things are banned in universities. But when you actually follow your wisdom in your heart, it always works. It's brilliant. You repeat that and it won't work.
So don't repeat it, okay?
No.
So Ajahn Brahm, there are probably many married couples here. And I think one of the challenges of being married is to be happy, to stay contented being married. And there's always this chance that someone is going to stray. So how do two people who are going to commit their lives to each other for the next 40, 50, 60 years of their life and stay happy with each other?
Have you seen couples like that? Couples have been together for 30, 40, 50 years and are happy.
Few.
But they exist. So what wisdom does is investigate what is their secret. Why have they got this wonderful relationship together? And there's many little tricks there. One of those tricks, and I know this, because I've never been married, it's just, again, the attitude towards one another. You may all know that there are two main types of Buddhism, the Hinayana and the Mahayana. The Hinayana is supposed to be my type of Buddhism, really Theravada, where you're just into it for your own enlightenment. That's what people say anyway. It's like selfish Buddhism. Mahayana is selfless Buddhism, where you sacrifice everything. You'll even give up your enlightenment for the sake of other beings. Of course, that's not true, but that's the myth. But I've noticed in a marriage, there's usually one partner is Hinayana, the other one is Mahayana. And it's usually the girl who's Mahayana. She sacrifices everything for the relationship. She is as stupid as the man who is Hinayana, who just wants what he can get out of the relationship. Now that's a generalization, that's not always the case, but it serves the purpose of what I'm going to talk about. If you're selfish, just seeing what you can get out of the relationship, your own fulfillment and satisfaction, that's not a relationship at all. It is selfish. It will die. And if you are the Mahayana partner, sacrificing yourself, giving in to the other person again and again and again, you too have no part in the relationship. You burn out, there's nothing for you left, and that is why the relationship ends. And I said that because there's too many women in relationships take the Mahayana stand. And as I said, in Buddhism, in real Buddhism, and I know what I'm talking about, There is no such thing as Mahayana or Hinayana. There's just Buddhism. That's all. And Buddhism would always teach you the middle way. And the middle way is being able to look at your partner and say, this marriage is not about you. To look at yourself, it's not about me. It's about us. A marriage, a relationship is about us. So I tell you, don't think of yourself and don't think of your partner. It's all about us. You have a part in it. But it's not only you, it's us. Which is why when there's a problem in marriage, whose problem is it? Our problem. It's not my problem, it's not his problem, it's not her problem. It's our problem. That means you're actually building up a relationship. You're working out these things as a pair. Too many marriages end when we blame the other person. It's your fault. You're not spending enough time with the family. You're spending too much time with the BF. That is wrong. That's blaming another person. Or sometimes we blame ourselves. Oh, I should not have been at work all the time. I should have spent more time with my family. No, it's not your fault. It's always and always will be our fault. The worst thing about a marriage is the way people speak to each other. There's an old story that in the first year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the second year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the third year of marriage, the neighbors listen to both of them.
Ajahn Brahm, what they happens argue. If one of them commits adultery or is inclined to commit adultery? How does one remain happy in the marriage?
That's an interesting question. Is it one of them commits adultery? Is it his fault? Or is it our fault? It's amazing if you think it's our fault. The two of you sit together and think, how did we get to this position? When there's blame, it's not a relationship anymore. Your fault, you fix it. When it's guilt, no relationship. I neglected him, I should have spent more time with him. I shouldn't have had more headaches when he asked for sex. Whatever it was, don't get angry and guilty yourself. When it's a problem, it's our problem. It's amazing how you can find innovative ways of fixing it. When it's our problem, it means you're both investing in finding a solution. When it's our problem, it means there's still a marriage there and you want it to move forward. There is failure. You're just one of you has just trodden the dog shit. You haven't dug it under the tree yet, you've brought it back into the bedroom. Start digging in that shit. Get some more mangoes. And the amazing thing is, I've seen that and done that with families. There's one family in particular, I remember spending a lot of time with them. He started visiting the prostitutes. And she found out. She wanted to totally divorce him. But I'd known them for too long. Talked to them again and again and again. Realized that there was a common problem. It wasn't just his problem, it was her problem, it was our problem. Finding a solution. And they're such a happy couple now. Out of gratitude, they come and feed me every week. So I won out of that one too. It can be done, but the attitude is the main thing. And that is where wisdom comes. Stop blaming yourself or blaming others. That's not wisdom. That might be intelligence. It's his fault. You know, I trusted him and he went out to some China girl, went out with a secretary in his office. You may think that's intelligence, but you find it doesn't solve the problem. Wisdom, you know it's wisdom because it leads to peace and happiness, harmony. It solves problems. That's a sign. That is wise. And that's actually what the Buddha said to Mahaprajapati Gotami. You can tell it's the Dharma, it's wisdom, If it solves the problem, it leads to peace, harmony, and freedom.
Ajahn Brahm, what do you say about having arguments? Because a lot of times before you get to that stage, there's been a lot of exchange of hurtful words and unpleasant actions taken.
Arguments are great. I love arguments, especially if we could argue some more. It makes it really interesting when there's an argument on stage. It's exciting. But no. Arguments, I remember growing up with my parents and they would argue. I mentioned, I think, yesterday, they grew up in a very small apartment. So small that we couldn't get away from each other. And my brother and I, we argued a lot and fought. But what I saw from my parents, yeah, they argued. But then, it was only 1 hour, 2 hours afterwards. And one of them, either my father, usually, or my mother, would kiss and make up in front of my brother and I.
And so that was, you and your brother kissed and make up every time?
Yeah, we did eventually. I mean, you saw us at my 60th birthday party.
Yeah.
We've got a beautiful relationship there. Love each other to bits, would always do anything for each other. And the amazing thing was that what I learned from that, it's all right to argue. Now, we're human beings, we won't see eye to eye all the time, we will argue. But the wonderful thing was that we knew how to not hold it for too long and to make up as quickly as possible. And it didn't matter who was right and who was wrong. There was never any sort of, I'm sorry, I was wrong, or yeah, you were wrong. There was never anything like that with my mother and father. They'd argued and basically they said, oh, forget the argument. And they just hugged and kissed. And what I learned as a child, it was arguments are okay. They're part of life. There's nothing wrong. Don't feel guilty about arguing. But the beauty of settling that just by making up, kiss, a hug, smile, whatever it is, and moving on and not holding it for day after day, week after week, year after year. It's called letting go, compassion. That's why we have love and compassion. If we didn't make mistakes, there would not be the need for love and compassion and forgiveness. So there is those problems. Make up, for goodness sake. And if you've got a partner sitting next to you, you've had an argument today, and you just don't want to talk to him, or you're really upset at her, for goodness sake, this evening, promise me, you'll give them a hug and say, look, let's forget this. Make up. Put it beside, behind you. And go out for some really expensive dinner. I don't care what.
Ajahn Brahm, there are couples that may not have stayed together, they have split up. So what's your advice to them if they have children? Because often children get caught between two adults that are vengeful or still remain very angry, blaming each other.
Yeah, I mean, get those are intelligent men and women rather than wise ones. It doesn't help anyone when you carry anger. When you want to hurt the other person, you only succeed in hurting yourself. That's all. This was something which I told some young people in Kuala Lumpur a couple of days ago. And I grounded this in basic Buddhism. There was once an emperor, Ashoka, the emperor of India about 2300 years ago, one of the first royal Buddhists who really pushed Buddhism forward. And he left in his empire in India these rock pillar edicts where he carved in stone messages for the people of his empire. And one of the most famous of those rock edicts was for religious harmony. It would be wonderful even in Singapore we could actually copy that in a big rock pillar so every person of every religion could read that and practice it. And what it said was anyone who criticizes another person's faith only succeeds in degrading his own religion. And that was so wise. If you criticize Christianity or Islam or Buddhism or Mahayana or Theravada, that says more about the person doing the criticism than the object of their criticism. It demeans the value of their faith when they criticize others. And that could be extended, you know, to families as well, especially when going through a divorce. You criticizing, using the kids as a wedge between you and your ex, all that really does, it says much more about you than it does about your ex. So remember that edict. Criticizing and putting down other people out of anger, that says much more about you as a person than the person you are venting your anger at. Don't do it, stupid. And also, don't go around criticizing other religions. You've heard me many, many times talk about the simile of the old man and the violin. I'm not going to say that because that's in the book. But certainly, when you respect another person's religion, that enhances your own faith. You're someone who really understands tolerance. And that's an important part in the growth of wisdom in our world.
And perhaps changing gears, I think today most of you have heard the news that very young talent Emma Yong has passed away from stomach cancer. She's an actress. And I think it's always hard to deal with losing your loved ones. So what would be the wisdom that we need to apply whenever we lose someone very dear to us?
You never lost them. You gained them. It's amazing we say, what a great loss it was she's died. What a great gain it was for Singapore that she lived for so many years and entertained people for such a beautiful high standard.
But she could have lived longer.
Because she could have lived shorter. Who knows? But instead of looking with negativity, we look with positivity. Didn't I say yesterday the simile of the concert?
No, we didn't touch on that.
Okay, because this is the Buddhist, I think this is probably what Angie was getting at, because this was the wisdom which I developed with my own father's death. Now, I often mention my father. He was a role model and a very good one. And of course, I loved him to bits. I love him to bits these days. He died when I was only 16 years of age. And I remember just, my mother died just a couple of months ago, and it was like nostalgia, the same crematorium, and the same Mortlake Cemetery in West London on the River Thames. We went there, same chapel, hadn't changed at all. So it's just memories of when I went there for my father's funeral. But when I went there for the funeral service, I never felt sad. I never cried. I never cried since. I never felt sad at my father's death, even though I loved him very much. And other people thought I was strange. So I thought about that when I became a monk. One of the great things of being a monk is you have time. You have time to contemplate and think and meditate and work out what all these things really meant. Eventually I came up with an understanding of how I felt. Remember, it's very hard for a young man, especially a male, to understand their emotions. But when you meditate, you really get to know them. And the way I got to know the emotion I felt at that time was comparing it to another emotion which was almost identical. And I came up with the wonderful simile of the concert. Because as a young man growing up in London, I loved music. I went to see the Rolling Stones when I was 11 years of age. I remember seeing the very first concert of Led Zeppelin in the Marquee Club, Wardour Street, Soho. I loved my music. I used to watch rock bands. I remember going to the Isle of Wight concert a few times. I was a hippie. No, I didn't take drugs, but I had long hair and green velvet trousers, all that sort of stuff. You wouldn't believe I had long hair in those days.
You can get the book that has got a picture of
long hair.
Yeah, my mother, and a mane.
That's why my mother kept on telling me to get my hair cut. When I did, she said, that's not what I meant. But anyhow, I remember even going to this concert in the north of London, and it was a band was playing, and I went with my brother. We had talked about this at the 60th birthday party when he came to visit me. Only six of us turned up to watch. A tiny audience. And I expected the band to take a look, only six people listening to them, and go home. But they didn't. They played. It was almost like a private concert. You know who the lead singer was? Rod Stewart. Private concert with Rod. Now, those are the sorts of memories I had of that time. But I also remember that at the end of the concert, everybody would, you know, stand up, clap, and shout for more. Actually, you don't do that at the end of my talks, do you? I'm miffed. Now, anyhow, we always used to do that. Stand up, clap, shout for more. And the band would play the encore for another 5 minutes. And when the encore was finished, that's when I had to go out and leave. And the band would go home. And I knew that the chances of listening to that music again was zero. It was finished. The concert was over. And I also remember London. In the evening after the concert, she'd always go out into the cold, dark, gloomy London night. And I also remember it as raining. Not real rain. The rain called drizzle. If you want to get depressed, go to London and go out in the drizzle. It can't even rain properly. And it was always, should have been depressing. But whenever I went out of those concert halls, knowing that the music had finished, and knowing I would never hear that music again, never once did I cry or feel sad at the end of a great performance. And I recognized that was precisely exactly how I felt when I walked out of the chapel after my father's body was committed to be cremated. I walked out knowing I would never see or feel or talk to that man again. The concert was over, but what a wonderful performance that had been. I felt joy, inspiration, gratitude. Thank you so much for those 16 years. The same feeling when you've just been to a great concert. You feel uplifted and so happy. That's the way you should look at a death of someone you love so much. Thank you, Dad, for all those 16 years. I will never, ever forget that performance. And I haven't.
Ajahn Brahm, could it have been also that you were a good son? Because in Asia, we are very indoctrinated to be filial. And a lot of times when our parents pass away, we are filled with guilt because perhaps we haven't done as much as we could have to return the gratitude of their kindness.
I was born in England. I couldn't even spell filial.
Exactly.
I certainly didn't practice it.
That's why you but didn't I have any guilt.
But I still felt guilty. You know the thing which I remembered afterwards, which did make me feel guilty? My father used to love playing Frank Sinatra. That was his favorite performer. I loved Jimi Hendrix. Sometimes I would play my Jimi Hendrix while he was listening to his Frank Sinatra. Jimi Hendrix is much louder. I won. And you know, that was the sort of silly things you remember when somebody's dead. Why did I do that? You know, my father loved his Frank Sinatra. I should have let him listen to it, even though I didn't like it. Now, it's my father's favorites of music. And I thought afterwards how cruel I was to my dad. And he would never tell me off. And after a while, that sort of made me feel guilty. But one of the things I did, you know, that was real guilt. One of the things I did was actually to one day, again, being a monk, I didn't have a photo of him, I just visualized him. I went into the hall in the temple, visualized him, and said, Dad, for all those times, you know, I treated you like that. And this was just an example of the sort of thing, like a young boy growing up competing with his father. All those times I played my Jimi Hendrix records so you couldn't listen to your Frank Sinatra. All the times I irritated you and hurt you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I was a kid growing up, and I love you to bits. I always will. Please forgive me. I did that with really sincerity. I meant it. And I just saw in my mind, you know, the picture of my father, what he would do. He said, of course, you're a boy growing up. I probably did worse when I was a boy. Just really straight forgiveness, because that's a parent's love. Can forgive anything, no matter what your kid has done. There's a beautiful feeling of finishing off that guilt. I'd been forgiven. And I could say, well, I was imperfect. I learned from that. That was my 30% mistakes. I wasn't a bad kid. You know once that my father almost beat up my teacher at school? The reason was, I'm going personal now, but it just shows you, you know, my father and my relationship with him. I went to just the ordinary poor people's school with lots of migrants. But, you know, I did well and got top of the class and got a scholarship to this very good school in West London, Latimer. The best school you could possibly get to from my position, scholarships all the way. And when I started off, I was, you know, not very good, but then, you know, the old small fish in a big pond. But I worked my way up and started to come top again. And that's when one of my teachers, at the Parents' Day, told my father, your son is very intelligent, he'll probably go to Cambridge University. That was the first time I was spotted by one of the teachers. And my father got really angry. And almost had a fight with the teacher. He didn't want me to go to university. And the reason was, it was taking his son out of his world. My father's world was the pub. It was, you know, the soccer stadium. It was, you know, working in a certain class of people. And Cambridge University was the elite. You know, the highly intelligent, you know, the aristocrats. He thought the university would take his son away from him. I understood that. That's how much you love a son. You just want him to be in your world as long as possible. As they had this big fight, I was told by the other kids, because the parents told the kids and the kids told me the following morning in the playground. And the teacher took me aside and said, do you want to go to university? I said, yeah, sure. And my father obviously relented. It was just a reaction. When you love someone so much, you want them to be in your world forever. But he was wise enough. No, no. Off you go.
But Ajahn, how do you deal with parents or people around you who are not wise enough and they hang on to you or you hang on to them?
Well, this is it. I mean, I was very unfortunate to have such a good dad because I didn't learn as much as you guys did. It was an 80-90% dad instead of 70%. Because sometimes my father, you know, he told me his experience. His father, my paternal grandfather, was someone who was totally absent from my life. My dad never talked about him. It was only later on when I squeezed it out of him. I said, well, come on, you must tell me about your own father. He's my grandfather. I know he died a long time ago, but I need to know about him. So my father decided to open up. First of all, he said, your grandfather was a bastard. And that shocked me. I mean, that really was like a hammer. What do you mean? You can't talk about your dad like that. And then he explained. He was brought up in Liverpool in the Depression years of the late 30s. And my grandfather was a plumber, just a very, very menial job. And after work, he would come home drunk. I mean, really drunk and violently drunk. Get out his leather belt. And he'd whip any child who came close. My father's job was to not be there when he came home. But worse than a beating for doing nothing, was seeing his mother, my granddad's wife, then also being whipped with that belt. Domestic abuse. In a time when there was no recourse at all. My father hated that. To see the mother just beaten almost every night for nothing. Just because my grandfather was drunk. That's called a victim of domestic abuse. Psychologists tell me that usually people who have been abused like that will do the same abuse to their children. My father never did. He turned totally the opposite way. He told me, he said, when I was being beaten for nothing, he said, I made a resolution, I made a promise to myself, if ever I survive, if ever I have children, I will never hit them. And he never could. A couple of times he tried, but he just gave up. He just couldn't do it. We were naughty enough to deserve that, me and my brother. But eventually my mother had to get the slipper out, but father couldn't do it. And that's why I loved him to bits. He told me why. Because you're abused and hurt, it does not mean that you should abuse another person. You learn from that dog shit never to do anything like that to another being. It hurts. It really hurts deep inside. It's not the welts. That's not what hurts so much. It's why they were given to him. It's not the emotion, it's not the physical pain, it's the emotional pain which hurts the most. And that's what happened to him. So he became this wonderful, kind, gentle person because he was a victim of abuse. So if your partner has abused you, has gone off and you know, had an affair with someone else, that's not an excuse for you to lower yourself to the same level and get angry or even fire them. It's no excuse at all.
Ajahn Brahm, in dealing with attachment, I think we all know that that's the cause of much of our pain or our suffering. But what if we're attached to our own life? I mean, we find out that we're ill or we have cancer. We're not like Venerable Dhammananda who can laugh when being told that, oh, you've been diagnosed with cancer. Because many people are still fearful of death. So how does one deal with illnesses, especially if they're terminal?
Someone once defined life. Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Think about that, that's so accurate. You know, sexually transmitted terminal, that's called life. So straight away we know that, you know, we are terminal. You just put it off for a while when you get healthy again. But when you are sick, there's two parts to the sickness. There's the physical pain and the physical discomfort. You know, that is bearable. It's not that hard. But the worst part of it is the emotional turmoil. And the first part of sickness, which is the emotional problem, is guilt and denial. It's as if that sickness is stigmatized. In Singapore society, there's a lot of stigmatization to people who are mentally disabled, who have schizophrenia, who have some other deformity. They're stigmatized if, you know, they don't do pass their examinations and go to university. That stigmatization of society also goes to illness. It's as if it's wrong to be ill. I realized this when one day I was feeling very sick. And I went to the doctors. I was in the waiting room to see the doctor. And a friend who I would teach meditation to came into the same surgery, took one look at me and said, I never expected to see you in here. And I thought, my goodness, I was so embarrassed. It was like I was in a brothel or a pub or something. What do you mean? Aren't monks allowed? He said, look, you eat healthy food, you meditate, you're supposed to be healthy. And I thought, no, can't I get sick too? And I realized just how easy to feel guilty about being sick. You didn't look after your health. You didn't exercise enough. You didn't eat the right food. It's your fault. And because of guilt and fear of sickness, the emotional problems, that's one reason why people don't go to see the doctor soon enough. You girls, sometimes you know there's a lump in your breast. And you're so afraid you don't go quick enough. There's nothing wrong with having breast cancer. The quicker you get there, the better. Cancer's a word, not a sentence, as they say. In other words, you don't die. Most people survive. Just get it done quickly, as soon as possible. And to help that, I tell people in Australia, in Perth, this is very common now. So any doctor who hears this, say, oh, we'll go again. That's one of Ajahn Brahm's disciples. When you go to see the doctor and there's something ill with you, you've got some sickness, please tell your doctor, doctor, there is something right with me. I'm sick again. Please don't say there's something wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with being sick. It's part of life. So when you go see the doctor in this hospital, if you're a real Buddhist, if you've got wisdom rather than intelligence, you'll go see the doctor. Doctor, there's something right with me again. I'm sick. Because that takes away a lot of the guilt and the fear. Takes away the first level of emotional problems with the sickness. And of course the next thing is the fear. When the doctor says, that's cancer. I'm going to die! Ah! Or if they say it's terminal. Oh my God. What's the next question when you say, the doctor says it's terminal? You also ask how long, yeah? Just like that guy who was told he had terminal cancer, he said, how long? The doctor replied, 10. He said, 10 what? Months, years? And the doctor continued, 9, 8, 7, 6. That's terminal!
So how do you overcome the fear of death? I mean, really, if you're going to die soon, right? So how do you overcome the fear?
The fear of death. Look, you're Buddhist. You've done it many times. It's here we go again. Number two, think, hey, I've escaped the old people's home. I don't need to go there anymore. I'm going to die young. Do you like to go to old people's home?
Is that what you want? But what if you didn't do a lot of good deeds and you haven't been a good person? It's dying is even more frightful.
If you haven't done good deeds and if you haven't done a lot of bad karma, then the Buddhist Fellowship, they've got this group who visit you and you can sign over all your assets to the Brahm Center, which really needs it. And if they such good karma, you can die happy. I get in trouble for that again. But
your
anyhow,
last chance of getting elevation.
That's right.
In your reincarnation.
Well, that's what people do sometimes in countries like Singapore. A little bribery here or there. Come on, please, can you get me a free ticket up to heaven?
And I think we'll have to put a condition there. In case you don't die, we'll refund you. Because then you'll be too worried that you're going to be very poor because nothing left.
But if you refund, you can refund in the next life. That's what I say.
With
look,
credit.
It's a guarantee. If you give a big donation to the Buddhist Fellowship, you know, I guarantee you'll have a wonderful good karma. You have a very happy rebirth. And if I'm wrong, you can always come back in your next life and claim your money back. Money back guarantee!
Ajahn Brahm, we'll move to the next topic, which I think a lot of people probably do have issues with. Working, right?
Working, what's
We're
that?
All working. Now, most people get a new job and they get really excited. Oh, I got a new job, I got a promotion, or I got a new career. And that lasts maybe a few months. And then they start complaining about the colleagues, they complain about the hours, they complain about the boss, they complain about the demands of the new job. So over and over again. I see all the time. People get really excited. And then I can just see it coming. They're going to come and complain a few months later.
Look, stop complaining. When I was young monk in Thailand, first year, when we would travel from one place to another, it was in the back of a truck. Just like you see here in Singapore, you know, the big tray in the back where all the workers sit, you know, and the big shots sit in the front in the cab. There was a very smaller tray. And the roads in the northeast of Thailand were all dirt roads with big potholes in. And just like the cabs or the trucks here with the trays in the back, there's always like a metal framework over which they've stretched a canvas, you know, to protect you from rain. So I had to sit in the back. And whenever that truck hit a pothole, the truck went down. I went up and I smashed my head on those metal bars. Why, they really hurt. And it was okay for people like you. You've got padding.
And you're shorter.
And you're shorter, yeah. So I hurt my head first. I was bald with no protection, and that really hurt. So I was English. If you see an English person or any Westerner hit their head and it hurts, what do?
They swear.
Swear, yeah. You were married to one, so you should know. So they swear. So I sweared. But every now and again, the pothole was so deep that even the Thai monks hit their head too. You know what they did? They laughed. I couldn't believe it. How can you? They must have hit their head and it must have hurt as much as it hurt me. How can you laugh when it hurts so much? So I decided, being trained as a scientist, to start a few hypotheses. How come you can laugh when it hurts so much? My first theory was those Thai monks had hit their heads so many times before they were all brain damaged. How else would you laugh unless you're mad? But then I knew those monks, they weren't brain damaged. So I thought, how can you laugh? So I decided to do an experiment, a good scientific experiment. I resolved the next time I hit my head, which actually was only a few seconds later, I would laugh instead of swear. Sooner or later, yes, bang! And it's weird. I discovered a great secret. If you laugh when you hit your head, it hurts much less. It does, it doesn't hurt so much. If you don't believe me, can you ask the person sitting next to you to please hit you on the head? But laugh and it doesn't hurt. Swear and it does.
I'm sure with whatever hurt they came with tonight, it's all disappeared, right? Because you've been laughing all evening.
Yeah. So laughter gets rid of the pain. Everybody knows that. Doctors know that. It releases endorphins in the bloodstream. It's immune sort of enhancers. You can't feel the pain. You've got energy. Which means that when your boss hurts you, they don't hit you on the head. Well, sometimes they might, metaphorically anyway they do, when they scold you, give you extra work. Instead of complaining, laugh. And then you don't get hurt so much at work. So when the boss says, here's extra work you have to do this weekend.
I think he'll probably take the work back. Because he probably thought you've gone mad.
And then he will give the work to somebody else instead. Yeah! But it is true, don't complain about it so much. It's the complaining which is the problem, not the work.
But seriously, I did have a boss one time who used to lose his temper. And we used to talk about him all the time because we always said, well, who did he lose his temper with today? And I decided that before I walked into his office each time, if he ever shouted at me, I would just stand up calmly and walked out. And that's what I did. He started shouting and I said, excuse me, when you've calmed down, I'll come back. And I'll just walk out. And I only did it once. And he never ever scolded me again. He scolded everyone else because they would stand there and let him scold them. But because he knew I'd just walk away, so he never used me anymore as his victim. So it works. Another time he was shouting at this guy, and because he was so red and he looked so ridiculous, the guy couldn't stop smiling and started to laugh.
That's my method.
That's right. And then he stopped scolding. So there you go, you got a couple of tricks now. So John Brown, what happens when you get discontented at work? I mean, you feel that, oh, you're not getting anywhere now with your career. You feel that you're not getting any more pay rise. There you go, you want to find another job because you want looking for new challenges. Is that discontentment good because it's about making progress in your job or your career and earn more money, or is that just another foolish thing?
Well, it always depends, but in my career, sometimes I think I'm not making any more money, I'm stuck. No more prospects. I look at my prospects for work and they're miserable. I have to keep talking like this until I'm in my box. No retirement for me. I've got no money stashed away anywhere where I can just sit and relax and don't talk anymore. So sometimes I think, can I change my job? And say, I'm too old, no one want me now. So instead I think, no. I appreciate having a job. I appreciate being fed. I appreciate the money I have. But sometimes I just feel, oh, gratitude, this is good enough for me.
How you don't much have any money.
Yeah, that's why it's good enough. How much more do you want? A very wise saying which you can think about again and again, and it gives you the secret of happiness. And why people don't have happiness. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. Brilliant saying. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. That's almost the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha in a nutshell. How much more do you need? When you keep wanting more, you just don't enjoy your life. At least on the weekend or when you finish work, enjoy what you have. You deserve it, you worked hard for it. When you go to work the following morning, okay, then you can want more. But don't always want. It means you can't enjoy your beautiful wife, your lovely husband. You can't enjoy your nice house or apartment. You can't enjoy your kids or your dog or your parrot, whatever you've got. You can't enjoy life. When you want something more, you just don't appreciate what you have. You just can't see what you have.
Well, a lot of times people can't because they often see the faults in other people. And not only that, you want to change other people. Because if only he's kinder, if only he's more peaceful, if only he's more generous and stuff like that.
So you don't change other people, you change yourself. Would it be wonderful if your partner heard that?
Well, a lot of times people leave the hall and then something happens. Says, didn't you hear that, what Ajahn Brahm said?
Yeah, so that's why we record it, so you can give it to your partner and play it to him when he's asleep. It's subliminal. You know, you put some, when he's fast asleep, you know, put the headphones on him so it goes in, subliminal. I've got to be kind, I've got to be forgive. I got to be content with my wife, she's a good wife. I got to be content with my husband. A lot of times is that contentment. And this is, again, I like sometimes getting serious. That sometimes I look at you guys, I've known a lot of you for a long time. You're far from perfect. I know all of your faults. That makes you so lovable.
Because you only see us once in a while.
Now I can see deep inside of you guys. I have my powers.
No, but you don't have to put up with us every day, unlike people we live with, right?
You don't put up with people you live with all the time. You go to work, you go to the toilet. But no, it's even the people I live with in monastery over in Serpentine. even the people you see every day, and I've known many of you for a long time, and there's something which you see the beautiful part in those people. This afternoon I spent a couple of hours in Changi, in Section A. That's the hardcore prisoners. Such beautiful beings, those prisoners. One of them who murdered his mum. Another one who stole, I don't know how many millions. Such beautiful people. This is something which I developed to be able to see a person and see their goodness, their beauty, just how wonderful they are. And I started doing this with, again, people in jail in Australia. When I went to see them, they said, oh, he's a murderer. That guy, he's raped kids. And I looked at him, I couldn't see a rapist. I couldn't see a murderer. All I could see is a person who'd murdered. I could see a person who'd raped someone. But I saw a much bigger picture. And the other part which I saw was a very beautiful guy or woman who made a huge mistake. When I saw the other part of them, I could respect them and love them. When I respected and loved them, it was strange. There was a person visiting their prison who treated them like an old friend, not treated them like a criminal. And that was such a surprise to many of these prisoners. They talked about this afterwards. They started to see the same in themselves. What I saw, they saw. They weren't a murderer. They weren't a rapist. They weren't thieves. They were people who'd stole it. There was a bigger part to them. When they saw the other part to them, they could respect themselves. They had self-esteem. And once they could see that, the path to rehabilitation and freedom was there for them. And they never went back to jail after they went to my classes. And I see the same in you. You're not perfect human beings. You've got all your faults, the bad bricks in the wall. There's such beautiful parts in you. And that's all I see. And that's why, look, I'm not exaggerating. I love the whole lot of you. You're just
Ajahn Brahm, but whenever we're with you, we're always in good behavior.
That is because I see the good behavior in you. I don't see the bad stuff. If you could do that with your partner, if you just look for the good stuff in your partner will always be on their best behavior. What you look for is what the person shows you.
Ajahn, sometimes even in your monastery, you have monks who complain about each other because they have no choice now. They're living together. Yeah. They have to see each other all the time. So how do they cope with living with another person who often irritates them? Either the way they speak or their manner or the way they respond to certain things?
We tell them that it's not the other monk who irritates you. You irritate that monk. It's the old story that when we complained to my master, Ajahn Chah, about the villagers making too much noise, he told us it's not the noise disturbs us, we disturb the noise. What he was saying is it's the nature of people to have an irritating part. It's the nature of dogs to bark. It's the nature of husbands to be like your husband. They are all the same. Believe me, you haven't got a faulty model. They're all like that. And the same with wives. You think that maybe if you can trade in this model for a younger one, you might have more fun, but it's exactly the same. Summer, summers, here we go again. It's true, you know. So after a while, we don't disturb the irritation of another person. That's who they are. We love them for who they are.
So Ajahn Brahm, what is your last bit of advice for everyone before we end the session tonight?
Okay, I think you can see it. Secret of happiness, the secret of health, and how to be happy and have no worries in life, is to deliberately see that beauty in yourself, first of all. Yeah, you've got lots of faults, lots of things which you think you should fix up. Don't fix them up. You wouldn't be you if you fixed them up. You wouldn't be lovable anymore. Over in Western Australia where I live, you have these amazing sunsets over the Indian Ocean because our monastery faced west. You have the beautiful views. And the best sunsets, the really beautiful, gorgeous ones, are the ones when there's a few clouds on the horizon or a bit of dust. You need some imperfection to spread these amazing streams of gold and purple and fluorescent yellows over the horizon. Without those clouds or dust, you would never see a sunset. The imperfections make life beautiful. If you ever go into the forests, you'll never see one tree which is perfect unless it is a plantation done by the government. But in real forests, the trees are all over the place. They're imperfect. That is why it's so beautiful. Life, nature, it's always got these bumps and these scars and these so-called imperfections. That's why nature is beautiful. You, like the trees in the forest, you like the sunset over the Indian Ocean. It's your faults, the clouds, the dust, the scars. That's what makes you so beautiful. If you can see what I can see, you'll be at peace with yourself. Happy. That's not intelligent. That's wisdom. Because wisdom, it makes you at peace. Not only are you able to live with yourself, with all of your faults, with all the things you've done wrong, you're not getting rid of them, you're saying thank you for them. Those are the clouds on the horizon which spread the beautiful colors of the setting sun. And if you can love yourself like that, as you are, without changing yourself, just change your attitude, then you know the secret of living with a partner. You love them for who they are, with all their faults, but you love yourself. Peace at last. Easy. Okay.
Thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm. Let's put our hands together to thank Ajahn.
Do you remember the simile of the concert? Encore? We want more. We want more. That's good. I like it.
They're such obedient disciples of yours.
No, they're fun loving. They mess around like I mess around.
Well, we are hoping that Ajahn Brahm will be back in July. So we're planning for that. But of course, if you're coming to the executive retreat in June, there are still the cheap tickets to get to Phuket. You might have to go one day earlier or Saturday evening, and I think there's only about $60 to fly on Jetstar. So do check it out and come and experience meditation. You can have the option of doing the easy part or the more blissful part where you don't talk for 5 days. It's a wonderful experience. That's when you find silence. And when you don't talk so much, you have a better chance of becoming wiser. Did you want to say something?
No, it's okay. Carry on.
Okay, please also join me to thank all the staff of the Buddhist Fellowship and also the volunteers. And also to thank our Rinsa Hospital staff and especially the technician up there. Thank you. So the next few days, as I mentioned earlier on, Venerable Hasapana, who has arrived, will be giving talks. Venerable Hasapana, please rise.
Stand up. She's one of the products of my nun factory. I have two factories in Perth, one making monks, one making nuns.
And Ajahn's compassion extends beyond just building good monks, but also developing good nuns. And that's why he's been supporting the setting up of the Dhammasara Nuns Monastery in a Theravada tradition. There's very few of them. So he's dedicating all the donations that you may be giving to his monastery, to the Nuns Monastery. So do make a contribution when you go out. I think this is also an opportunity to make very good karma, to overcome our stinginess or selfishness. It's indeed an act of great merits.